Fan Thoughts with Will and Clint, Fridays at 6, presented by Breckenridge Brewery.
Happy, happy hour on a Friday evening, everybody. Welcome back. I'm excited to say that yet again, I have my main man, Jamie Mack. How are you doing tonight, my friend?
Do you think that the Will ever be here? Do you think that'll come into play?
The thing with Will, he's very mysterious. He's very mysterious.
A.K.A. known as
the Magic Man. Mm-hmm. Now you see him. Now you don't.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy to be here with you.
Thanks, mate.
Be safe out there, everybody. It's a little slick out there.
A little slick.
Some of us came down from the greater Evergreen area, and it was actually, you know, starting to get worse up there, and we came down, and certainly be safe.
Well, I think that's a great segue into, when you say us. You brought one of your best mates down, Corey.
It's true.
Sully Sullivan. And we're gonna be going through the whole story of your life, the whole bit, you know, what's good, what's bad, where are we at in the second segment. But Corey Sullivan is our special guest this evening. How long have you known Sully, mate?
Boy, it's been, what year did we, I'm going to say?
That would have been 04.
04 was
the Tommy John year.
So we got thrown into a foursome. Well, it's probably a fivesome. Actually, it was a sixsome.
Because I could only putt, and Jason Young could only putt.
Jason Young,
we're talking
former
golf, yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Let's hope. Yeah.
We had a Vinny Castilla no-show, and the replacement was two gentlemen that had just gotten brought up by the Rockies. And Jason, I believe, a pitcher from Stanford.
Correct.
Who had broken his ribs actually throwing the baseball. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Throwing the baseball.
Yeah, and he uncorked himself, but and then Corey was just coming off of Tommy John, and he could only putt. That was the only rule. And
he's very demanding.
Yep. Well, I think that I don't know, about six or seven holes in, I think Corey looked around and looked over his shoulder and just tried to make sure that Clint Hurdle wasn't looking and said, let's just give this a rip.
Didn't take long.
And drove the ball. And that's when I knew we'd be fast friends, because more of a guideline than a rule guy. So that's, I knew.
And that's why he belongs on our show, because, you know, the hours of preparation that we put into this 2-hour segment on a Friday.
It's true.
People just don't give us enough respect for it, really, Jamie.
No, matter of fact, there was only, I don't know, probably a half hour worth of really, really strong preparation that went into the Corey Sullivan.
And we squeezed that into 15 minutes.
That's right.
I was privy to the bull session that took place.
Yeah.
I mean, it was impressive how much you guys grinded and how many topics you covered in such a short period of time.
Hold on, I'm still breathing.
There's no length that we won't go to get this right.
It was good.
You know, I like to be as current as possible. That's just the kind of, you know, what are we?
Well,
hostesses.
You have many leather bound books.
I do indeed. All right. Let's actually start to talk some sports. There's been some interesting, I'm going to say it's a week of one-offs. And by that, I mean like things that have happened within games that are larger than that. But there are a lot of talking points this week. We got Zion. Did you see Tiger's shot today, Jamie? We're not going to delve into
it.
But did you see Tiger's shot today?
The fact that when Corey and I were driving down, we were discussing, actually we were listening to golf on the way down in Mexico.
Must have been an exciting conversation.
At the Chapultepec, different than the Al Chapultepec a few blocks away from us.
Yeah. Very just a little different. Bit. Yeah. Very not as good as jazz.
Very good. Very good. Very good. But the fact that that Phil went 79-65,
yep,
I believe.
Yeah, and we were discussing how that just doesn't happen. You can't do that.
Mentally, yeah. Mentally, I don't know how that happened.
Is that the best swing since Tin Cup? Was it, what was that guy's name?
Yeah, Roy McIlvoy?
Roy McIlvoy.
Come on, you're better than that.
Roy McIlvoy.
To say I don't know who that is?
No, I want to say, you know.
Like, we know.
But how in the world did a great ball striker like yourself, a legend, manage to shoot an 83?
Absolutely. Well, you know, I missed a 3-foot putt on 18.
Yeah.
I mean, shooting 79-65, he just couldn't drive the ball yesterday.
Which is strange because just based on the altitude, which even higher than out here in Mexico City, the fact that you'd assume, and I didn't see this, but I would assume that, that Phil is taking iron off the tee, that would be something, you know, from a conservative standpoint, you'd think that he'd be fine there. And then to shoot 79 and then come back and shoot 65, I don't even know mentally how even a professional like Phil does that. I really don't. Because as Corey had mentioned on the way down, there is no cut line in this event. So usually when they say they mail it in after that first round of 79, they go up and they just kind of show up and then they get their plane first trip out of there.
Gotcha. Gotcha. You know, what's really interesting, and it's not something that we were going to talk about tonight, but I'm going to bring it up and just see if there's any correlations with you guys. When I was doing a lot of consultancy with IMG down in Florida and I came out here to altitude, my immediate thought was, well, there must be some positive to training at altitude. And at the end of the day, these guys are so fit normally to where there's not like a big upside unless it's like preparation for the Olympics, if you're a swimmer or a boxer or something like that, just to where, you know, we're talking seconds of conversion. There's been a trend now that there's more money in Mexico to where people are coming to altitude to train in both golf and tennis.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily at the highest level, although it's starting to creep in, but there are a lot more, I'm not going to say major dollar tournaments because I don't want to use that word major, but big dollar tournaments in tennis. And, you know, you have a massive tennis background, Jamie. Like, that was your sport in college. Am I incorrect in saying that?
Be very correct. But the fact that the fact that the altitude and the training, when I first came out here, there was no question that Phil Dent was I think he was an Australian tennis player.
Good looking bloke. Yeah.
Had the fastest serve. And I think that at altitude, you're going to get that, the influence of not only with, certainly with baseball and the humidor, but tennis, same situation. And I think the training out here, certainly from when I first moved out here, it definitely took its toll, and it was a different, you know, just like anything else, golf.
The ball goes further, it flies, it doesn't move as much. There's all those things. And in tennis of all sports, I think that it's probably highlighted more than anything else. Cause it's not so much a fitness issue, but if you're trying to, you know, you're using a different ball at altitude.
Yep.
Like it's not the ball reacts differently.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different ball.
And when I had come out here and started playing and just playing just the small money tournaments out here, the rackets were starting to change. So people were moving away from the standard pro staff and getting into the hammer and the wide bodies, and the changes in the frames were changing too. So that's why I gave it up. I couldn't take it anymore. That's why I decided to drink more and play less.
I love to reminisce, and we're talking about the adjustment of rackets. Basically, I remember the transition from wood to aluminum, and I'm trying to say it like an American. Was it aluminum or steel?
Steel.
And the one that I remember, my uncle Lex had it, and I thought he was the coolest dude. Still do. This racket like curled around. It was like two streams that didn't meet until it was within the handle.
T2000.
Oh,
the T2000 steel frame. Hold on. I think we just lost. Yep, we lost everybody.
Yeah.
We lost all the listeners.
Andy Zodin's.
Yeah, that's right.
Andy Zerker.
The changes in the frames at that point certainly. The T2000 was the the steel frame, and T3000, and I could go on, but I won't.
Well, I am. Do you think, I have an opinion on tennis, like I do, most things, over-opinionated, under-educated.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that technology of equipment has affected a sport more than tennis. And when I say technology, I'm saying legal technology. I'm not talking about corking bats and trying to sneak things through. I think tennis is a different game.
I think
last
that,
thoughts on that.
You know, well, I will say this, that when we did our kind of our pre-show, you know, we talked about the differences in the whether it's being, you know, the sports that are being, changed because of rules or mm-hmm. because of equipment. So mm-hmm. we can talk more about that.
I like it. We'll be right back.
Take it. Baby, every place I go reminds me of you.
Clint Goodchild, Will Evans, Fan Thoughts, Fridays 6 to 8, presented by Breckenridge Brewery.
Now, while Will Evans may not be in the studio this evening, I do think it is pertinent of us to do a shout-out to Society Sports and Spirits. Denver's voted award-winning number one sports bar last year by Westward.
Hello, Will.
Hello, Will. I hope you're listening somewhere, my friend. Stay warm. Stay warm. I want to pick up the conversation. Where we left it off, Jamie.
Yeah.
Equipment, tennis, yep. the adjustments in the game. Has there been a sport more affected by technology in the equipment side?
I think that, you know, certainly golf is right up there. The fact that tennis in the 70s and where, you know, tennis is now is certainly in America, because we don't have a ton of American players on the male side anyway, you know, in the top 10. But there's no question that back in the 70s and the 80s, there was so many serve and volleyers, and just the style of play, the transition from that style of play to mm-hmm. where it is now is totally different. And, you know, your swing speed and the fact that your style is changing based on the equipment. Now, we just talked offline as far as the using like a hickory stick with golf. And you will adjust, and certainly the players that have played in during this transition in tennis and in golf have faced not only from a balata ball to the golf balls, the equipment changes in golf, and I think that's those two sports, no question, have had the biggest change with equipment.
Now, Sully.
Yes, sir.
What's your feedback on those thoughts, my friend? You know, technology's slowly creeping its way into baseball. Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing. I think, the traditionalists would say we don't want to see an automated strike zone. You know, it takes the human element out of it. And I don't necessarily think you have to take the human element out of it. You just, balls and strikes are called. The umpire behind the plate still calls the ball or strike once the computer lets him know. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a buzz on the hip for a strike or a ball. Yeah. As a player, we just want to call it right.
Yeah.
A finite strike zone. Yeah, I think that's the hardest thing is when it wanders or changes. And, you know, let's say hypothetically a 1-1 pitch is called a strike and it's actually a ball. That completely changes the count for the hitter, where you go from an offensive count to a defensive count. I think we've shown that instant replay is a good thing. I wish they would communicate to the fans in the stadium and at home right away what the call was and why. I think that's one thing the NFL does incredibly well is they communicate that. And in baseball, we lack that. We struggle with the fact that we may sit there and watch a guy listening on a headset for 3 minutes and we don't know what they're saying to him and we have no idea what they're seeing. And then he comes out and just tells you the call and that's it. Let's go.
Yeah. It's really interesting you say that the NFL does it really well too, because I think most viewers get frustrated with the fact that, listen, most of us at home have a large TV with the ability to pause and to freeze frame and to go frame by frame. And they, you know, they still feel the need to have somebody at, you know, at midfield run over, look at something, as opposed to the AAF, which I don't know if you've checked it out, but it's interesting because they allow you to literally listen in. And I don't know if the NFL has enough, wherewithal to expose themselves to that conversation. But there's no question that the fan gets very frustrated. And I think the fact that we all know that there's enough camera angles and enough camera providers that they can put cameras on a lot of different things throughout a stadium. And the most frustrating thing for me is when, you know, you're sitting there with a bunch of people at a party and you're watching a game and all of a sudden it's the wrong call.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, we should know that before the NFL knows that.
To kind of bring it full circle, I think it's interesting too, the way this same concept has leaked into golf, where viewers at home mm-hmm. would see a rules infraction right. and call in. And in that way, technology is I think it gets in the way, unfortunately.
Well, just real quick, that you know, the biggest thing with the golf that hinders the field is that the players that are being viewed are the players that are in the top 5-6. So when that rule was eventually originally changed with Craig Stadler putting down his towel so he wouldn't get his pants wet, became a a call in, and yet because he was in the final five type of thing.
Yeah.
You and I 25th, 28th, down the nobody's watching us, and a viewer would never be. So that puts field at
If I may jump in here, and I always promised that I wouldn't talk a lot of cricket on here, and I won't talk cricket because I see the the snooze emojis just coming to everyone's eyes as we speak.
We just talked tennis, so that's okay.
Yeah, you thought that was the low point.
Hey, I've heard cricket is 2 weeks of a blast. That's how long a game takes, right?
Well, if it's a good game, yeah, any excuse not to go home. So the thing with cricket is we're about 15 years ahead of where baseball is, and of any two games that I've had any association with, I think that there's so many similarities, not just in the traditions of the game, the expectations of the experience. Cricket has embraced technology and it has improved the game, and I might be coming from a former player standpoint, but you don't want to get punished for getting it right. And I think that that's the thing. You put hours and hours of energy and effort, you sacrifice, and then you make it guesswork.
Yeah.
And to me, that's not fair. The experience with cricket now is to where whatever the review is live on the big screen within the stadium. Mm-hmm. And the listener at home hears the conversation between as well. In the stadium, you've got the crowd, you've got the enthusiasm, and it's ball tracking technology similar to that of golf and similar to that of the beep of tennis as well.
The Mac cam in tennis,
yeah,
to your point.
It's incredible.
And the fact that the fans get into it.
I'm all for it because at the end of the day, I think there's nothing worse than the best not getting rewarded for being the best.
And
it destroys my spirit when I watch baseball these days.
And really, especially if you don't have a, even when you do have a dog in the fight, you don't want to win with a bad call. You don't, and I think those are the things whether you're...
Are we broadcasting New Orleans? You sure? Is this signal going to the Saints fans out there?
There's a boost somewhere by the Mississippi that gets there.
I think we just picked up an extra 20,000 listeners. They're on board.
They're supporting us. The thumbs up.
1,000%. Mardi Gras just got bigger.
But that's some of those are judgmental calls. Yeah. Some of those things are, put the helmet to helmet. I don't know why that wasn't called. And I think that those are the frustrating things for a fan are the things that just aren't called correctly.
Well, and let me tell you, I think the opportunity, and NFL is playing, is teasing it. In cricket, you get the opportunity to challenge as a player during the game. So if you feel there's been a bad call, so let's say you've been called out, and I'm not going to enter the details of what out is in cricket. You've been called out and you go, oh, hang on, that is a shocker. Mm-hmm. You make the tee, you put your fist on your forearm, you make a tee, and they have to review that play. Now, there is not an unlimited number of reviews. You only have four that you can use in a match, and a match can go for 5 days in test match cricket. Now, the shorter format of the game, it's more fire, it's more fast-paced, it comes quicker and all those things, but it's all relevant to the length of innings in a sense of how many reviews you get. And I don't think that would be a bad thing to put the players in power because emotion comes into it. There's guys with egos and it brings the fans in. He's like, oh, he's not going to review this again. That guy never thinks he's out. It's great.
And I do think that, the ability for umpires when they make those calls, but on the other side of it, a manager has coaches that are looking at the replay. They wait there 20 seconds before they decide to throw the red flag, or even in baseball, they've got people looking at replays that obviously the manager doesn't have a TV right there, but they've got coaches, they've got people that are, they're waiting for that to happen and to make, to give them the advice to make that call or not, or to challenge it.
So what I love is that it's a direct process. Like if you're nose down, heading to first, and you swear that your foot touched base before that ball slapped into the glove, you can turn around and go, I was there. And that puts a whole nother element into the game that fans love.
Mm-hmm.
They do. They eat it up. And because there's emotions
I would
involved.
Argue, Sully, that 9 times out of 10, you do think you're safe.
Even definitely, I've never seen an umpire call a strike on me that was not a ball. 100%. All of them
were
balls. They were all balls.
I look forward to hearing more about all the balls when we get back after this break. Thank you very much.
Clint Goodchild, Will Evans, Fan Thoughts, Fridays 6 to 8, presented by Breckenridge Brewery.
I want a girl who knows what's best.
All right, listeners, I hope you're traveling safe out there. Don't try and rush home. Relax and listen to the sultry sounds of Sparky and Jamie as you make your way home. And we have our special guest here, Corey Sullivan. Now, Corey's been giving us some great insight in a number of areas, but Corey, why don't we actually tell these people everything about you, mate? You're a baseball legend here in the Rockies.
Well, not enough to get on the wall here. I've looked around and seen the names. And
you haven't been to the bathroom
somehow
yet.
Sully is missing.
Have you been to the bathroom yet?
Is it on the urinal?
It's just you.
100%.
It's just
100%.
You. 100%. Yeah. My friend, your journey into professional baseball and beyond, into broadcasting, where did it all begin? Where did your love of the game start?
My love of the game started from my brother and my father. My brother was about 7 years older than me. So when I was pretty much able to walk, I wanted to do what he could do. Unfortunately for him, I exceeded his baseball skills once I learned how to bunt, because that honestly is the only thing my brother could do, and he attests to that to this day.
Really?
Yeah.
One of the great bunters.
He would argue that he could walk into a major league game right now and bunt, and I can single-handedly tell him he cannot. But, you know, just going out, watching him play when he was young, I loved it. I've told this story before, but the way I learned to be a good outfielder would kind of shock you. I've never told you this. I was about 7 years old, and my dad wanted to go hit golf balls. And I said, okay. He goes, you know what? Grab your glove. For every one you catch, I'll give you 25 cents. He took his 9-iron. I went out about 150 yards. He has not hit anything but a driver that far in about 20 years.
That's fantastic.
Sorry, Dad. And the irony is the first one I would have caught, except for the fact that I had an H-back glove, and it went right through the pocket, hit me right in the eye, and that was the end of that day. We went home, and my mom let my dad have it for letting me try and catch a golf
ball. Well, your old man can't say that you didn't have your eye on the ball.
Exactly.
At least, right?
Like that was his whole argument.
That's 101. Yeah. He's got his eye on the ball. He's going to
we'll
go
blame
far.
The equipment again, aren't we?
We are. Well, I mean, when it goes through the glove, it can't
that's
be
tough.
Fair enough.
That's
fair
tough.
Enough.
That's tough. Now, your love of the game may have started with humble beginnings. Where did you really realize that you were a step ahead of most around you?
To be honest, it was probably about 10 or 11. My 10-year-old team was probably one of the better sports teams I've ever been on.
Great.
We played 44 games in 37 days.
What?
11 tournaments. We went 44-0. We won all 11 games, or all 11 tournaments.
Really?
And we were all very successful, but I think at that point I was like, okay, there's something here, you know, the hand-eye coordination. Yeah. I was a little bit bigger than everybody then. That eventually caught up with me. But I think from that point on, baseball and soccer were pretty much my life at that point, from 10 till 18. And that's all I did. And baseball just started separating itself. I started having a little bit more success. I guess I would actually say soccer, I was probably more successful up until 17. I was, you know, part of the national pool. I made the regional team for ODP, for Team USA. But baseball was always there in the back of my mind. Like, I knew that was what I was going to do.
Yeah.
Soccer just threatened it for a little while.
Gotcha.
And then, you know, high school rolls around. You start contemplating where I'm going to go play collegiately. Mm-hmm. I had lots of opportunities around where I grew up in Pittsburgh to play collegiately, both baseball and soccer, but to this day, my parents actually give me crap about an interview I gave during my senior year about what I was going to do to go play baseball. And, you know, they were asking if I was going to play at Pitt or Penn State and all of that. And I said, to be honest, if I want to pursue this as a job, as a career, I feel like I need to go somewhere south or west to play better competition. And my parents are like, wow, why would you say that? How can you say that? And, you know, truth be told, they get to play all year round. Yeah. It is a better competition.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know I was going to go. My whole family went to the University of Arizona. So I was going to go walk on at the University of Arizona because I didn't have an opportunity to get a scholarship there. So that's my senior year ends. That's my plan. And one of my friends who was 2 years older than me was a center fielder and a pitcher, left-handed. His name was Justin Ross, went to the University of Tennessee to play football and baseball.
Really?
And he calls me in mid-June and goes, you know what? My roommate, his name is Jeff Pickler. His father is the coach at one of the top junior colleges in California. And you should think about that. I flew out that weekend to go check it out. I went through a workout with him. He said, I think you'll be all right. We'll give you an opportunity to fight for a position. I ended up being their starting center fielder. I played 110 games my freshman year, which was 94 more games than I played my senior year of high school.
Wow.
And then I played 110 my sophomore year and basically had an opportunity then to choose where I wanted to go to school.
Incredible. And where'd you go?
I kind of hedged my bet. I went to Wake Forest. I took an opportunity of baseball to get my education and wanted to make sure that I finished college. I made that very clear to everyone that if I had gotten drafted after my junior year, I wasn't going to sign. I wanted to finish. I wanted to have that just in case.
And we'll come back to like this point in the timeline, but Wake Forest, Hall of Famer. Interesting induction class, I believe.
2013, I was inducted into the Hall of Fame. It was Josh Howard was inducted that year. Timmy D was inducted. Chris Paul came just after that. It was pretty fun opportunity. And I think
Timmy D's a rapper. I think
Tim Duncan.
Tim Duncan.
Yeah. Of all the NBA players, Tim Duncan probably does have the largest street cred.
Oh, 100%.
Oh, man. That guy's an animal.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I have a funny story about Wake Forest. I'm in my psych, I think it was either 211 or 212. It's a statistics class, and they go through the average annual salary upon graduation at Wake Forest from Wake with a psychology degree. And, you know, everybody's sitting there expecting them to say 50, 60, 70. They're like, it's $274,833. And we were like, what? And they go, thanks, Tim Duncan. That was his major at Wake Forest.
Wow. That's hilarious.
That was pretty fun.
Now you finish your college run.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you at?
I got drafted in 2001 by the Colorado Rockies in the seventh round. And I was incredibly lucky because my college roommate, Dan Conway, was drafted by the Rockies the year before. He was in Asheville, North Carolina, playing for their A-ball team. After I signed my contract, they decided to send me to Asheville, North Carolina. And guess what? It's 100 miles from my college, and my college roommate is my teammate now.
That's fantastic.
And it made the transition very, very comfortable because a lot of people struggle with that first segue into professional baseball where you're really taking care of yourself.
Yeah.
You're, homesick. You know, you have to pay rent. You have to do all of that.
Yep.
And having Dan there, just it was like having my brother there, honestly. Just being able to get up, do everything, who knew how I played, knew when I struggled, knew how to talk. I mean, it made it really, really easy.
Yeah. You had a mental coach around you basically the whole time. How long did it take you to break into the big leagues?
I had a very quick ascent, I would say, especially back then. 2.5 years is all it took.
That is quick.
2.5 years, and I was in the big leagues. 2004, I obviously missed a year for Tommy John surgery, and then 2005, opening day, I make the roster, and never look back from there. That's kind of the way it goes.
It's not a bad period to be coming into the starting lineup for the Rockies. They had a little bit of a purple patch there, pardon the pun.
Yeah.
We
were known as Todd and the Toddlers back then.
Todd and the Toddlers?
Todd and the Toddlers. That was the name we were all given.
Because
Todd was the senior statesman, and a lot of us can't, you know, myself, Brad Hopp, Matt Holliday. I know you don't know a lot about the Rockies history.
Hey.
Holliday, Barmas, Atkins, Francis. All of us kind of came up together, so we were the Toddlers.
Well, and talk about the fact that, you know, as far as the injuries that maybe helped that, you know, that quick ascent.
Well, I think Preston Wilson was the starting center fielder then. He had knee surgery, and they needed somebody who could play day games after night games center field. And the roster at that point was a little bit limited with guys who could play center field. Brad Hopp was going to be the right fielder. He was a first baseman all the way to Double A. And then they realized, well, he's probably not going to play first base for us because we have this guy named Todd Hill. So they moved him to right field. And Matt Holliday was a third baseman coming up, and then they moved him to left field. So now you've got limitations on who can actually play center field. And, you know, I had a great spring training. I actually ended up winning what was known as the Abby Greer Award, named for a young lady who was killed outside the stadium.
Oh, wow.
And that was an honor itself. And, you know, kind of just backed into making the opening day roster because I could play center field and had a great spring training.
Well, one of my favorite things to always say, mate, is I'm not a big believer in luck. I think luck is preparation meeting opportunity, and you may have got your opportunity a little sooner than others.
Luck is but the residue of design.
Oh, I like that too, but I won't remember it. But, you know, it sounds like you got an opportunity early and you grabbed it with both hands and you weren't willing to let go. Would you say that that's fair?
I think that's fair. I think when you get the opportunity to a culmination of a dream, right? Yeah. I mean, when I was a little kid, that's all I ever wanted to do, and getting the opportunity to actually walk out on a major league field and put on the uniform and take batting practice. And then my first at bat is against Trevor Hoffman, a Hall of Famer, in the ninth inning of a game with two outs. It's literally the storybook that you write when you're a kid and you practice and you're in the yard with your friends going, bottom of the ninth,
down by two. Yeah.
And I mean, I should have retired after my first game.
I don't think that's the case, because a couple of years later, you played in some major games, which we're going to get to right after this break.
Clint Goodchild, Will Evan, Fan Thoughts, Fridays 6 to 8, presented by Breckenridge Brewery.
Welcome back, listeners. The Mile High City, let's do a shout out to our good friends over at Mile High Spirits. If you haven't been in there, go check it out on a Friday and a Saturday, especially on a night like tonight. You won't have to leave, you won't have to take on the slippery sidewalk. It is a great location and a great product.
Very not spirited.
Just, oh, very spirited. Mm-hmm. They're very passionate about what they do. I loved that lead-in song. Now, Corey, we're talking about you're in the majors now. What was your first at-bat song in the majors?
As a rookie back then, you didn't get to choose this.
Really?
Yeah, so I honestly couldn't tell you. I can remember the moment like it was yesterday.
It was probably organ-based.
Yeah, I can honestly remember every single pitch of the at-bat. I cannot remember the 15 seconds from the on-deck circle to the batter's box.
This was 2005?
Yeah.
I feel like it must have been.
I can remember batting practice. I can remember talking to my dad while I was taking batting practice. I can remember all of it. But that 15 seconds, I can't remember. I have no idea. I don't know if I warmed up.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
That's hilarious. I want to find out. That's like, I'm going
to
go on.
When I got to choose my song,
yeah,
I had the White Stripes' Icky Thump at one point.
Oh, great leading.
I had Blood Rave, which is from the movie Blade. It's the scene from The Rave. I loved it back then. It just made me want to run through a wall, which is what you want to do when you hit.
You are full of surprises.
That's great.
I like it. Now, 2005, what was it? Todd and the Toddlers?
Todd and the Toddlers.
Todd and the Toddlers. Now,
he was also the Todd father. He was the original Todd father, because they like to call someone else the Todd father, Todd Frazier.
Fantastic.
But it was Todd Helton.
Seems like the Toddlers grew up. 2006?
7.
2007.
Yeah.
Well, I'm saying 2005, 2006, 2007. 2007 season, where did you guys turn the corner? When did you just get hot?
Well, we really got hot mid-September, but I think there was a road trip. If I'm going to probably get close to the dates. It was the end of June. It involved Toronto, Houston, and I want to say Pittsburgh, where I think we went 1-9 on the road trip. We got crushed. We got walked off 4 or 5 times. That was the point in the season where we were all like, okay, something's got to change. Yeah. And the guys in the clubhouse, honestly, it was the most unique group of guys and band of brothers I've ever played with, because I've never seen a group play for one another better than that group. And that's really what it was. It was a group of men fighting for one another.
A willingness.
And once September rolled around, there was a conversation that happened in the clubhouse with myself, Josh Fogg, Aaron Cook, Jeff Francis, Matt Holliday, where we started looking at the schedule and we were like, okay, we're 7 games back, but the team we're 7 games back from, we play 7 times. They've also got to play some other teams. We started doing the math and we were like, wait a second, if we win every game, we will win the division. And we didn't win every game. We lost the Friday game of the last series against Arizona. Mm. But had we won every game, we would have won the division. And honestly, it was one of the most incredible runs. Jamie, I mean, you were there. You witnessed it. It was amazing.
And the thing that's amazing about that is that, you know, certainly from the viewership side, you know, people think back in 2007, well, they made the World Series. They must have had a great year. Nothing changed until September. And then even when September happened, to your point, you have to look at it like, oh, we have to win every game. And, you know, you're looking at like, well, they're not going to win 10 in a row. They're not going to win 15 in a row. And, you know, winning 21 out of 22, that doesn't happen.
It doesn't.
At any level, for the most part, certainly the professional level. So, you know, being a small part of watching that and being part of the, you know, the broadcast that was taking shape was remarkable every day to come in and say, wow, they did it again, and they did it again. So let me ask you this, though. When you get 10, 15 games into it, you know, talk about momentum. Talk about that.
Well, that's what I was going to say, is you guys both grew up playing sports. You both know the concept of the zone, right? Mm-hmm. Individually, it happens frequently. As a team, it doesn't happen very frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not kidding. We came to the ballpark knowing we were going to win. Mm-hmm. None of us. I can't even remember having a conversation about any game that had previously happened. Like, oh, last night, this. Normally, that happens every day in the clubhouse. Yeah. We talk about an at bat or a pitch or a
right.
sequence. That never happened. It was, okay, who do we got today?
Yeah.
Who are we going to beat today? It was that simple. Yeah. We didn't know who was going to be the hero. We didn't care. It was, what's my job today? If it was for me, if I wasn't playing, okay, I'm coming off the bench. Who am I going to face?
Mm-hmm.
What am I going to do? How am I going to help the team? And if you go back through those games, sure, there's Todd, there's Garrett, there's Tulo, right? All the big names. But you look, and there is somebody else who helps that team win in a different way every single day. And that was what made that team so special. And that's how we maintain that momentum, is we didn't lean on one person.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you didn't have to lean. You know, we talk a lot about accountability, or we talk about, you know, how do you succeed in that moment?
Do
right?
your job.
Controlling your heartbeat. Honestly, we didn't care. Because if I failed, the guy behind me,
someone's got me.
Was going to pick me up.
You're not kicking
and when
yourself.
You have that feeling, that freedom, I mean, in sports, that's about as easy it gets.
How much of that is, you know, you talked about, you know, having, you know, essentially player meetings. How much of that, and, you know, with Clint's leadership, you know, went along with that?
I attribute all of it to the fact that we did everything as a group, whether it was playing cards on the plane or whether it was going to dinner when we flew into a city. We didn't roll like five guys, seven guys.
Right.
It was 17 to 20 of the 25 guys. Mm-hmm. The only guys who didn't go were the families who guys whose families
right.
came.
Right. Right.
We would roll in and have a dinner of 20 guys. And we would sit there and talk, whether it was family, baseball, you knew each other.
Right.
I mean, never mind the fact that we all came up together and we all had that experience.
Right.
I think one of the most valuable things in whether it's business or teamwork or any of that is when you fail, having the people around you that you know and can trust and can lean on, that when you can succeed, those same people are there.
Yeah.
It is, it's an awesome feeling. And that, I mean, that's what makes a team successful from my side. That's how we were so successful.
Culture is king. And I'm yet to see a winner, a consistent winner in all sports, that it didn't start off the field. Honestly, the commitment, the commitment to yourself, the commitment to the guy next to you, the commitment to the staff. If someone's given 100% and you're not, things are going to deteriorate. When everyone's giving their best every day, even if their best isn't good enough some days, giving your best will give you the result long term. I would like to do a little bit of a questioning. You were talking about childhood dreams. 2007, you come through the playoffs. First game of the World Series, mate. You're standing there. It's, you know, there's the big show and then there's the big show. Was it a reflective moment? Was it an intense in the moment? Like, where were you mentally? How was the preparation for that?
So I didn't start game one. So that gave me a little bit of an advantage in a way where I could be reflective.
Gotcha.
And we're in Fenway Park, which, I mean, let's be honest. It's as historic a ballpark as it gets. Having an opportunity to play in a World Series there was unbelievable. But I can remember taking batting practice and looking up at the Green Monster, because I had never had the opportunity of going into the Green Monster yet. And I was like, wow, you know what? I wonder if I'll get to go out there. And everybody wants to go out and sign inside the Green Monster. And I was like, because that would just be so cool.
Yeah.
After my batting practice ends, I walked straight out there. I went inside and honestly, I looked around at the names in there, and I was, the fanboy kid in me was like, oh, yeah. How did I get here?
Yep.
How did I get here?
Yeah.
How did this happen? And you know what? I signed my name, and it was one of the more surreal moments and probably one of the more ethereal moments I've ever had in my life.
That's fantastic. Yeah. We're going to pick it up with the 07 World Series after this break.